Madhava Kunja Bihari Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Jai Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yashodha Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashodha Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yashodha Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashodha Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Narayanam Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udirayet Nashta Praeshu Badreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. Good morning. We're speaking from Canto 2, Chapter 2, Text 17, chapter entitled The Lord in the Heart. Yatra kalo nimisam para prabhu
Yatra kalo nimisam para prabhu
Kuto nu deva jagatam ya ishriye
Kuto nu deva jagatam ya ishriye
Nayatra satvam narajatamascha Nayatra satvam narajastamascha Navai vikaro namaham pradanam
Navai vikaro namaham pradanam
Nayatra kalo nimisam para prabhu
Kuto nu deva jagatam ya ishire
Nayatra satvam narajastamascha
Nayatra satvam narajastamascha
Navai vikaro namaham pradanam
Navai vikaro namaham pradanam
Please chant. Anyone else? Word for word? Na.
Na.
Not.
Na.
Yatra.
Yatra.
Wherein?
Wherein.
Kalaha.
Kalaha.
Destructive time.
Destructive time.
Animisham.
Animisham.
Of the heavenly demigods. Hara.
Hara.
Superior.
Superior.
Garu.
Garu.
Controller.
Kuta.
Where is there?
Where is there?
Nu. Certainly.
Deva.
The demigods.
Jagatam.
The mundane creatures.
Ye.
Those.
Ishire.
The rules.
Na.
Not.
Yatra.
Therein.
Sattvam.
Mundane goodness. Na.
Nor.
Raja. Mundane passion. Tama. Mundane ignorance. Cha. Also.
Na.
Nor.
Vai.
Certainly.
Vikara.
Transformation. Na.
Nor.
Mahan. The material causal ocean. Pradanam. Material nature. Translation. In the transcendental state of Labdho Vashanti, there is no supremacy of devastating time, which controls even the celestial demigods, who are empowered to rule over mundane creatures. And what to speak of any supremacy of the demigods themselves? Nor is there the mode of material goodness, passion, or ignorance, nor even the false ego, material causal ocean, or material nature. Purport. Devastating time, which controls even the celestial demigods by its manifestations of past, present, and future, does not act on the transcendental plane. The influence of time is exhibited by the symptoms of birth, death, old age, and disease. And these four principles of matter, of material conditions, are present everywhere in any part of the material cosmos up to the planet Brahmaloka. But the duration of life of the inhabitants appear to us to be fabulous. Insurmountable time even brings about the death of Brahma. So what to speak of other demigods like Indra, Chandra, Surya, Vayu, and Varuna? The astronomical influence directed by the different demigods over mundane creatures is also conspicuous by its absence. In material existence, the living entities are afraid of satanic influence. But for a devotee on the transcendental plane, there is no fear at all. The living entities change their material bodies in different shapes and forms under the influence of different modes of material nature. For in the transcendental state, the devotee is guna-tita, or above the material modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Thus the false ego of, "I am the Lord of all I survey," does not arise there. In the material world, the false ego of a living being trying to lord it over the material nature is something like the moth's falling into a blazing fire. The moth is captivated by the glaring beauty of the fire. When he comes to enjoy it, the blazing fire consumes him. In the transcendental state, the living being is pure in his consciousness, as much as he has no false ego to lord it over the material nature. Rather, his pure consciousness directs him to surrender unto the Supreme Lord, as stated in Bhagavad Gita 7.19, Vasudeva Saram Iti Sa Mahatma Sudurlabham. All this indicates that in the transcendental state there is neither material creation nor the causal ocean for material nature. The above-mentioned state of affairs is factual on the transcendental plane, but is factually revealed in a transcendentalist knowledge of the advanced state of pure consciousness. Such transcendentalists are of two types, namely the impersonalists and the devotees. For the impersonalist, the ultimate goal or destination is the Brahma-jyoti of the spiritual sky, but for the devotees, the ultimate goal is the Vaikuntha planets. The devotees experience the above-mentioned state of affairs, by attainment of spiritual forms for activity in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. But the impersonalist, because of his neglecting the association of the Lord, does not develop a spiritual body for spiritual activity, but remains a spiritual spark only, immersed in the effulgent spiritual rays of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord is the full-fledged form of eternity, bliss, and knowledge, but the formless Brahmajyoti is simply eternity and knowledge. The Vaikuntha planets are also forms of eternity, bliss, and knowledge, and therefore the devotees of the Lord, who are admitted into the abode of the Lord, also get bodies of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. As such, there is no difference between one and another. The Lord's abode, name, fame, entourage, etc., are of the same transcendental quality, and how this transcendental quality differs from the material world is explained herewith in this verse. In the Bhagavad Gita, three principal subjects have been explained by Lord Sri Krishna, namely Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. But one can reach the Vaikuntha planets by the practice of Bhakti Yoga only. The other two are incompetent in helping one reach the Vaikuntha lokas, although they can, however, conveniently take one to the effulgent Brahmajyoti as described above. The translation once more. In that transcendental state of Labdho Pashanti, there is no supremacy of devastating time which controls even the celestial demigods who are empowered to rule over mundane creatures. And what to speak of any supremacy of the demigods themselves? Nor is there the mode of material goodness, passion, or ignorance, nor even the false ego, material causal ocean, or material nature. Namaste, thank you. I would like to ask for all the blessings of all the Vaishnavas present here, present online, and offer my obeisances. Pancha Kalpa Tadupyasya. Kripa Sindhu Vyavacha. Patitanam Pavanevya Vaishnavevya Om Namo Namaha. And the Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam Mahatmya from the Puranas describes so many nice verses and glorifications of the Bhagavatam. And one of them that it states is, one who reads daily or hears even a half or a quarter of a verse of Srimad Bhagavatam attains the results of giving 1,000 cows in charity. Just reads or hears a half or a quarter of a verse. That's just one line. Attains the results of giving 1,000 cows in charity. And my first thought when studying for this class and reading this verse was, I was thinking of statements as such, and thinking, well, often I just think this is sort of hyperbole in the sense to suddenly make a point of how important Srimad Bhagavatam is. But when I was reading this chapter, I started to realize that there's so much truth in this. Because when you study Srimad Bhagavatam, you start to realize that every verse is a gem on its own. And the beauty of the Bhagavatam is that you can look at it in so many angles. And that's why devotees who read a lot, they say, yeah, I've read 4, 5, 10 times the whole Bhagavatam, and I see more and more every time I read. Or I've heard, I didn't understand Srimad Bhagavatam until I read it the third or fourth time through. And I'm thinking, well, how is that possible? It's any book you usually read, you read it through once. You read it the second time, you might have missed a few lines, but it's the same storyline throughout. But then I realized the Bhagavatam is like a crystal, like a beautiful crystal with so many edges. And the way a crystal works, when the light shines directly through it, that light is reflected in so many different angles. And in each angle is a different color, and it just comes out very differently. But that one crystal can be the light can be shined onto it, and it can show in so many different directions. And depending on the angle, the color comes out differently. But they're all beautiful. So if we look at this verse in the context of the entire chapter, we're understanding that this last couple verses and the next few verses speak specifically of the process of Ashtanga Yoga and the process of realizing the Lord in the heart, which is the context of the chapter. If we were to zoom out and look at this verse in context of the whole Bhagavatam, then we understand what's happening is Krishna Maharaj just came to Shukadeva Goswami. He asked, what is the duty of a dying man? And Shukadeva Goswami, very brilliantly, speaking to all the different members of the audience who have different ways which they connect to the Supreme, different preferred methods, so to say, different preferred types of yoga to connect with God. But in doing so, he keeps his integrity to bhakti and concludes his supremacy through each way, through talking to each person. So there's this brilliance of Sukadeva Goswami there. Now, if you hone in just this verse, we start to see details, different stage, this stage of transcendence. How does that differ from being in the material world? And then if you go even more and you go into the purports of each and every single verse, there's so many different angles. Prabhupada takes that same verse into context, out of context of just the verse on its own. He quotes more verses. And then it's like taking a crystal and shining a light, and then the light goes to the crystal, and to another crystal, and the light goes to that crystal, to another crystal. And in this way, the Bhagavatam, so many angles, when you read it from so many different points of view, it's just beautiful, the shinings of light coming out in all directions. So I think it's so beautiful thinking about that, because in some ways I find more technical, philosophical chapters, verses a little bit difficult to understand, you know, easier to skip through. To slow down and read it and think about Bhagavatam in this way, even the most so-called difficult sections become so beautiful and give so much realization. So for this verse, I want to recap a little bit of the verse before, just because it gives a nice context. And then go specifically into verse 17. So in verse 16, Shukadeva Goswami is detailing how to become transcendentally situated. And so he says, a yogi should merge his mind, his unalloyed intelligence, into the living entity, and then merge the living entity into the super-self. By doing this, the fully satisfied living entity becomes situated in the supreme stage of satisfaction, so he ceases from all other activities. And so in the purport, it says, when the mind is absorbed materially, what is the result? So the mind is constantly working, can't be shut off. And the functions are thinking, feeling, and willing. So when the mind is absorbed materially, eventually the result is destruction. It says it acts for material advancement of knowledge, destructively ending in discovery of nuclear weapons. So the mind, when in contact with material nature, it only ends up in this stage. So Prabhupada states, the mind is to be manipulated by good and unalloyed intelligence. Unalloyed intelligence refers to rendering service unto the Lord. And he goes on to explain that we're always servants of something. And he says this really nice sentence that we're servants of our circumstances. So what's our current circumstance? Is that we're serving the dictates of lust, envy, anger, greed, illusion, madness, and so on. And in Vrindavan, 1976, Srila Prabhupada was speaking on the fifth canto, and there is a verse in the fifth canto, and it states, all the learned scholars have given their opinion. The mind is by nature very restless, and one should not make friends with it. If we place full confidence in the mind, it may cheat us at any moment. Even Lord Shiva became agitated upon seeing the Mohini form of Lord Krishna. And Sarvari Muni also fell down from the mature stage of yogic perfection. So Prabhupada talks really nicely about the mind here. He says, if you want to be a first-class yogi, always think of Krishna within your mind. Do not make friendship, and that you have become very much advanced. Now my mind is controlled. It's not that easy. And therefore it is warned, Narkuryat Garhichit, never trust your mind. Always distrust. In any moment, it, the mind, can drag you. And the verse is the example of Lord Shiva, the Sarvari Muni, who both very advanced, but because of the mind, letting the mind go just ever so slightly, to set the example that even them on a very high platform can come back in contact with the material nature through just not losing their focus of thinking about the Supreme Lord and letting it become dictated by the circumstance of the material world. He says, Lord Shiva is all right, but by their example, they are teaching us that a personality like me becomes victim by this Maya's influence. Then what are you? Why should you trust and make friendships with your mind that I am now complete artificially? Don't do that. Therefore, it is warm. Nakuryat, Nakuryat Karhichit. Never trust your mind. Always try to control. And the easiest method recommended in the Shastra and confirmed by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Harinama, 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 Eva Kevalam. Palo Naste, Vanaste, Vanaste, Vatyamika. So this is stated earlier. This is the situation of the mind. This is what we're dealing with constantly. And then it goes on, how do we go from there and get to this stage, which is really nicely described here as labdo pashanti. And this is at the end of the second purport prior to this verse. In his pure, unalloyed state, the living being attains the stage of full bliss, labdo pashanti, and ceases all material hankerings. And so here's the connecting point. When the mind and intelligence are merged in the Lord, and thinking of the Lord, and serving the Lord, and the intelligence is being engaged by using our nature to serve the Supreme Lord, and the living entity does not remain a seer, but becomes seen by Krishna. And so we remain a seer, we're using our own eyes to see, we're thinking we're the ones who are enjoying, we're the ones who are doing, we're the ones who control. And we take a humble position and understand our actual position. Then, only then we can be seen by Krishna. When we're seen by Krishna, then we can actually act according to his will. And in that state, in that place, and then we enter the state of labdo pashanti, this pure unalloyed state, this transcendental state. We go past the modes of material nature, and we become gunatita. So, then we come to this verse, and I felt like it was these two verses. It was like a little bit of a sales pitch, almost. If you're reading the Bhagavad Gita and you're trying to become convinced of spiritual life, and this is a really good selling point. You know, do you like feeling controlled?
No
one likes feeling controlled. Well, then you're in luck, because in the transcendental state, there's no supremacy of devastating time, which controls even the celestial demigods. So you're reading the Bhagavad Gita, you want to become free from everything going on around you, you want to transcend this material world a little bit and want to become spiritual, this is the remedy that's given. You don't like to be affected by the most material nature. Perfect. In a transcendental state, when we connect our intelligence and our mind with Krishna, we're not affected by the most material nature. Don't like unhappiness. Who likes unhappiness? No one likes unhappiness. Who likes illusion? No one likes illusion. Who likes madness? No one likes madness. So there's no false ego. There's none of this when we're in the transcendental state. So it's giving a really strong selling point to anyone who hears Srimad Bhagavatam that if we focus our mind on Krishna, if we think of Krishna, if we no longer become the seer, that it's our eyes, what we see. There's a a joke, the seafood diet. Anyone heard of the seafood diet? Whatever you see is what you eat. Seafood diet. It's almost like that in this material world. You see something, we like it, and then we're thinking about it, we're willing it, we want it, and therefore we are engaging our false ego, thinking we're the enjoyer. But in actuality, when we bring this wall down, then we can be seen by Krishna, because he's seeing us for who we actually are, which isn't that. And when we're seen by Krishna, then we can act accordingly. So I want to go a little bit through the purport and come to a certain point about the false ego. The purport states that devastating time which controls even the celestial demigods by its manifestation of past, present, and future does not act on the transcendental plane. There's no effect of devastating time. Since in material existence, the living entities are afraid of satanic influence. What does that mean? Satanic influence can mean, satanic can be two things. It can be of the devil or of Satan, or it can also be more generally translated as of evil, wicked influence, demoniac influences. But for the devotee on the transcendental plane, there is no such fear at all. The material, the living entity in the material world is always in a state of fear. even if we're not currently feeling so afraid in this moment, there's always the idea that we're not permanent, death is coming, or something might happen. There's a fear of the unknown. And so it goes on to state, the living entities change their material bodies in different shapes and forms under the influence of different modes of material nature. But in the transcendental state, the devotee is gunatita, or above the material modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. So it's by these gunas that causes fear, because we're controlled by the modes, we don't understand what's actually happening. But as a devotee, when we transcend this, the fear leaves us. Thus the false ego of, I am the Lord of all I survey, does not arise there. In the material world, the false ego of a living being, trying to lord it over the material nature, is something like a moss falling in a blazing fire. So the moth is so enamored and attracted by what it sees. Again, the seafood diet, it sees light, it's attracted by light, it wants to go to the light, but it doesn't know that it's a fire. Or maybe it does know, it sees other moths going to the light, going to the fire, and then burning up. But it goes and it burns up. And that's what happens when we think ourselves as the seer, think ourselves as a doer. We know it's not going to end well, but it's all we so-called experience, and that's how we've been conditioned. And therefore we do it anyways, and we enter the blazing fire of material nature, material world. So this idea of false ego, of identifying with oneself, of aham and mameti, of I and mine, that's such a fundamental spiritual understanding, that without this realization or acting from this place, almost nothing else can really be of value. We can't really progress spiritually if we haven't realized this point of who we actually are and of the false ego. So I was thinking, if we were to ask ourselves, if we were to hear the whole Bhagavad Gita, if Krishna were to speak the Bhagavad Gita, we were to skip the second chapter, if we weren't to speak about who are we? What is our identity? Are we the body? Are we not the body? But he continued on to speak the whole Bhagavad Gita, all of the 17 chapters. What would be the effect? He skipped the part that sets the tone, which is chapter 2. The perspective on the rest of it would change. We would have transcendental knowledge. We want to have the anchor, the root understanding of who we actually are. And it's from that perspective that we can actually understand the rest of Krishna's instructions. So we have so much knowledge, but the root of spiritual understanding would be missing. The anchor of bhakti is this realization that we are part and parcel of Krishna. We are not this body, and we are not, as stated in the purport, the Lord of all that you survey. And so without this anchor, it's like being a boat that's not tied properly to a dock, or not anchored properly into the sand. It just takes one wave, one little ripple in the water to pull you back. And just like that, you're back in the ocean without any way to get back to the shore. So for a materialist who has no transcendental knowledge, who has no spiritual understanding, as well as they don't understand at all who we actually are, and they're fully, completely lost, what is the effect? There's a nice story that I read in the book once, and it was explaining, it's a story about, well, it's a book kind of giving very relevant context to the Bhagavad Gita. It's called Gita in 3, or Gita Cube, so looking at from 3 different perspectives. And there was a group of friends, they went to New York, and they wanted to bond with each other. So they had this great idea of, let's go up to the Hilton Hotel in the penthouse and rent out the 80th floor. And everyone will have our own room, and then in the evenings we'll go out to the city and we'll enjoy. We'll bond together. We'll go see all the various attractions. So we visited all the various hot spots, and we just saw a theater show, and we went around and saw the tourist attraction. And when they returned, totally exhausted, but they bonded. So they went to the elevator, because their floor was all the way in the top. Went in and they saw on the buttons it said temporarily out of order. So exhausted, they said, okay, we have to get up somehow. Let's take the stairs. So they thought, okay, to make this a little easier, we'll tell each other stories, we'll tell each other jokes, we'll get our mind off of all of it, and we'll walk up these 80 floors, which is 160 flights of stairs. So they're going up one by one, they're telling each other a story, they're laughing, you know, 10 floors go, 20 floors go. Eventually they get to the 70th floor, and one friend in the group, he notices someone else in the group was so quiet, someone who's unusually quiet. And he said, okay, what's going on with you? You've barely said a word this whole time. And okay, spill it, what's going on? And he goes, well, my story is the greatest tragedy. Halfway up, I noticed I left the key at the reception. And they're, oh my God. And so the idea is, this is how most people go through life. They just go and go, and at some point they may notice, well, I'm missing something. I'm missing the key. But they just keep going, because ignorance is bliss. They have no other transcendental knowledge. They don't know what direction to go into. They don't know where to go, because they don't have the understanding of who they are in the first place. They go and they go without direction. And so he was just existing. He wasn't living consciously. He wasn't conscious of where. When you're living consciously, you're conscious of what direction you went into. And for a devotee, we understand the goal, we understand the process, we understand who we are. It's very clear. So every time we veer away from the path, we know what is our direction. But you pay no attention to the problem. You're just trying to make it through life. And most people are like this. They climb to heights in their career, and their family life, their academia, social status, and they just forget the key to what makes them actually happy. So similarly, you know, if we don't address this idea of the false ego, of I and mine, who are we identifying as, we will be the same, because wherever we, even whatever spiritual endeavors we have, if we don't have the right perspective of, okay, I'm coming as a spirit soul, as a servant of Krishna, eventually just like the boat, not anchored to the shore, it gets carried away with the ocean so easily. Even if the boatman knows how to steer, he knows how to be a boatman, he's trained, we can be a devotee, we can know all the processes of devotional service, we can have the theoretical understanding. The anchor's not anchored, the wave is much stronger than our own strength, much stronger than our own understanding, what we can do with our own knowledge. So then the question comes, what about for us? You know, we're not so much like the person, maybe sometimes, who went up the flight of the stairs and left the keys halfway. Because, you know, we're sadhakas, we're practicing devotees, some of us 40, 50 years, we've been trying very hard to understand, you know, that we're not this body, that we're going to practice Krishna consciousness in this place. So how do we progress? And there's this beautiful verse that gives a really nice understanding to Dhruva Maharaj, and Dhruva Maharaj is so advanced that also went through a similar difficulty. So Swami Vivamanu advises Dhruva Maharaj, this is in the fourth canto. He says, thus regaining your natural position and rendering service unto the Supreme Lord, who is the all-powerful reservoir of all pleasure, and who lives in all living entities as the Supersoul, you will very soon forget the illusory understanding of I and mine. Prabhupada states in the purport that Dhruva Maharaj is already a liberated person, already liberated from the age of 5 years old, because he had seen the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But even though he was liberated, he was for the time being afflicted by the illusion of Maya, thinking himself the brother of Uttama in the bodily concept of life. So Dhruva Maharaj had already attained liberation, he was such an advanced devotee, but still, even if we're advancing Krishna consciousness 40, 50 years, we can still, the example is given by Dhruva Maharaj, we can still forget Krishna, we can still identify with the body. And if it wasn't for Swami Vivamanu, it wasn't for Narad Muni, so many, you know, people in his life to pull him back, then Prabhupada says here that by the grace of Krishna and the sages and Lord Manu, reminding Dhruva Maharaj that he should not continue this material conception of life, of I and mine, simply by devotional service unto the Lord, his illusion can be eradicated without difficulty. But if it wasn't for them, then he would have to remain with this material world in different exalted or nasty positions. So that's the influence of Maya, and it's so strong, and this influence of identifying with the body could happen to anyone, even as a devotee. which is, yes, it can be a scary thought. And so the next thought, naturally, is what is the remedy? So, you know, if it can happen to Dhruva, it can happen to us. And how do we remedy it? And in Harinam Chintamani, it's really nicely described that this concept of I and mine is an offense to the holy name. We identify ourselves as the body. And it's the 10th offense. And personally, whenever I would hear the 10 offenses, it's like, okay, 1, 2, 3. I can go through these. I can eradicate these offenses in my own life. And then I get to number 10, and it's like, okay, it's a little bit difficult. I'll never, you know, so I always identify with the body. How can I not forget it? But there's a remedy. There's a way to no longer identify with the body, and only by getting rid of this block, this offense, can be achieved prema bhakti. Can we actually have shudanam? So in Harinam Chintamani, Haridas Thakur is explaining to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu about the glories of the holy name, the offenses of the holy name, and how to overcome them. And so he states that if one has heard the glories of the transcendental holy name of the Lord, but nevertheless continues in the materialistic concept of life, thinking, I am this body, and everything belonging to this body is mine, aham mameti, and does not show respect and love for the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, that is an offense. And he goes on to make a statement that I thought was very interesting, because I never heard it described in this way. He says, O Lord, please hear about this last offense, which is the worst kind of offense. When this offense is present, pure love for the holy name will not arise. I've never heard this offense described as the worst kind of offense. But it's also the most difficult offense to give up. As we've been conditioned, not just in this life, but so many lifetimes, to identify with the body and identify with everything around us. It's I, the body, and everything mine. It belongs to me as mine. So this is it's what keeps the heart very hard and makes it very difficult for pure love for the holy name to arise. He elaborates that this is the worst offense. Thinking in the bodily conception that one is a brahmana, a vaishnava, a king, a rich man, possessing a wonderful body, house, and family. The materialists sometimes take initiation, but eventually they fall away from the path of devotional service because of this offense. By committing this offense, one cannot get prema. So, as practicing devotees, as those who chant Hare Krishna regularly, it's really important to note that this conception of I and mine is a block in our main process to achieving Krishna prema, and our main process to loving Krishna. The worst offense, as stated by Haridas Thakur, is this: identifying with the body. So again, the example of an anchor. When we're anchored to this material world through false ego, we can't transform the heart. And we may have spiritual experiences, we may be in kirtan, we may, you know, from time to time our hairs might stand on end if the kirtan is really good, or maybe we might be emotional. We might have these spiritual experiences. And we might think that we're progressing in spiritual life this way, and we are. Those are signs that we're becoming better at being more open. You have practices, sadhana, etc. But it's like swimming with a rope attached to you if you still have this anchor of aham and mameti. If we're still attached to material life, thinking that I'm the doer, it's like we're swimming and we feel like we're going somewhere and it feels so good. But if that rope isn't cut, how far can you actually go? And Bhagavatam confirms this in the third chapter of this canto. It stated that certainly the heart is steel framed, which in spite of one's chanting of the holy name of the Lord with concentration, does not change. So if the heart does not change, the steel-framed heart does not change, when ecstasy takes place, tears fill the eyes and the hairs stand on end. And this all takes place, but the heart still doesn't change. Then, you know, that's the anchor that's still there. The tears can dwell, we can have spiritual experiences, we can feel like we're progressing very hard, very far, but we won't reach the goal of prema bhakti until this core anchor is removed. And that's the root cause. So Haridas Thakur states this, but he also gives the remedy for it. says, yes, this is the worst offense, but what do we do about it? So he states, the only way to overcome it, shunning these offenses, a saintly devotee should surrender to the holy name. According to the scripture, this surrender has six limbs. So only by this process of Sharanagati, to surrendering to Krishna, to surrendering the holy name, it's not a matter of our own effort. I'm not this body, I'm not this body, I'm going to do it, I'm going to not identify today. And then from now on, I'm not going to be identifying with this body. But matter, it's a way of getting your guard down, of not being the seer any longer, but being seen by Krishna. And so he just, I'm going to read through these briefly because they're so nice, especially the way he describes it. To accept everything favorable for devotional service, and to reject everything unfavorable for devotional service. To believe that Krishna will always give us protection. This is how we no longer identify with the body. To believe that Krishna will always give us protection, to identify oneself with Krishna's devotees, always feel inability without the help of Krishna, and always feel oneself inferior to Krishna, even though one may have full capacity to perform something on his own. So to become surrendered, to take shelter of Krishna, to eventually take out the anchor out of the shore, so that we're not just swimming in place with a rope attached to us. The goal isn't our own endeavors. The goal is surrendering to Krishna. And that happens by taking a very humble position. Even if we know we have the ability to do something on our own, we feel as Krishna, I don't have the ability. Krishna, I know that I'm in this place where I'm acting as a seer, as a doer, and I can't help it. It's my conditioning. But I take shelter of you, and I try to eradicate this offense. And that way Krishna sees us. And in that way, then our guard of I and mine, I am the doer, starts to come down. And in that way, we can attain Prema Bhakti. And it's so beautiful. There is one more statement in this chapter that I want to read that I found very interesting. Let's see if I can find it. Ah, yes, here it is. And so he talks about what's the remedy for no longer identifying with the body. Okay, it's the process of Sharanagati. But how do we approach the process of Sharanagati? So he goes even deeper. He states that to practice Sharanagati, here's what you need to do. One should seek out saintly devotees, associate with them, and serve them. That's usually the conclusion of any practice, of any way of advancing in spiritual life. Seek out the saintly devotees, seek out the sadhus, associate with them, hear from them, serve them. By doing this, gradually one's thoughts will be fixed in the holy name. By this mercy, by the mercy of the devotees, again, not on our own endeavors. Depending on Krishna eventually means depending on his devotees. By this, one's thoughts will be fixed in the holy name, and one will go beyond Maya, beyond the realm of I and mine. Hearing the glories of the holy name, one will turn away from the thoughts of I and mine. One will become a surrendered devotee. So I find it so nice in reading this that we've given so much material about how to overcome the root causes and difficulties in this material world. And I was especially appreciating the depth of answers to any question in the Srimad Bhagavatam that you get, or in any of our scriptures, because this past weekend I was helping in a conference, and the conference was of another faith, and there was a few devotees who were helping as sort of facilitators to amend the issues this congregation was having. So I'm in touch with some of the devotees who do this kind of work, and I wanted to volunteer and get a little more experience. And so I was doing this, and it was a Christian group, and I don't have so much experience outside of devotees. I always went to school with devotees, worked with devotees, friends with devotees. It's great, but it's also eye-opening and wonderful to see that other faiths have so much similarities. And but one thing I noticed, because we did this conference with devotees, ISKCON devotees, with this conference also with an outside religious group, is that when we were speaking in our in our circle, in the ISKCON circle, in a similar forum, all the points that would come up were so philosophically deep. It just keeps churning. And then in reading this, it was, Prabhupada states, when you identify with the body as I am mine, and then it's like a moth entering the fire, and you read that, oh my God, I'm entering the fire, I can't stop identifying. But if you just read a little more and study, then it's just, there's a remedy for that. Okay, the remedy is, you know, to surrender. How do you do that? There's 6 ways to do it. Oh, wonderful. How do you do that? Here's 3 more ways to do it. It's just constant. You just keep going more and more. You'll never get to a point where you don't know the answer how to do something. You can never use the excuse that I don't know the Krishna consciousness, because there's always an answer. And so, as much as you try to avoid making advancement, there's always people to help, answers to be given to any doubts. And so much appreciating this and this really important point of I and mine, overcoming the false ego. And so what lies beyond the anchor is this transcendental state. So if you want to achieve this transcendental state of pure unalloyed devotion to Krishna, it starts with breaking down that knot of identification and focusing our mind on Krishna. And in this way, it's pure happiness. So thank you. If anyone has any questions or reflections, be happy to share or happy to discuss. Thank you.
Thank you, Prabhu. Very nice class. So on the rope and the anchor, could you please explain that analogy one more time? I didn't quite get that. And then I have a follow-up question.
Yeah, so what anchors us to the material world is our identification with it. Because it's not our home, it's not our place that we're from. We're residents of the spiritual world, here in the material world, temporarily. So when we identify with the material world, that's keeping us, that's just anchoring us to the material world, that's keeping us here. And so it's like a boat. And you can think of the ocean, the waves, like the material, you know, the ocean, the modes of material nature that toss you this way and that way. And then our identification with this world and with this body, that keeps us here. So, you know, it's when we remove that, let me say it a little bit different. We remove that anchor, and then we're free from the bondage to this world. And even as devotees, we may still identify with, it's the first, you know, main primary instructions, the main reason we're practicing bhakti is to connect back to Krishna and remove this identification from I, me, mine, this world. And so we're trying to remove that anchor, that bondage, and so we can take shelter of Krishna so we can be free. And that was kind of the analogy I was using.
Thank you. So my question is, you said, you know, when we see from our eyes, you know, our eye, we want something, then as soon as we start seeing that, we had that kind of a, you know, desire thought. And then next step happens, then you start having a fervor for it, right? And that's where, you know, bondage starts from your eyes. When you see something, if you start having that feeling, okay, this is not me who is seeing it, it's actually Krishna is seeing it, then, you know, everything changes, then whole outlook changes. But then sometime, you know, that still that pollution happens, or this that when you see something, then you start manipulating your mind, oh, it's not your seeing, is actually Krishna is seeing, and Krishna wants that. So so, you know, I know that's a pollution in the mind, but what's wrong, and how can we remove that kind of thought?
Yeah. It's like I was quoting that verse that Srila Prabhupada was giving in Vrindavan, and he kept making the point, don't trust your mind. And I think that maybe there's a phrase that an idle mind is the devil's workshop. So when we just get stuck in the mind and our own thoughts and dwellings on things, and Prabhupada often calls that mental speculation, then we kind of take one point and create it our own, and, you know, we can't trust the mind, so it we take some philosophical point, we think about it, and we kind of make it all this and that, and become something else. Then we use spirituality as an excuse to serve our own senses. So I think it's being firm and knowing what's right and wrong, knowing what pleases the Supreme Lord, what's favorable in Krishna consciousness, what's favorable to our bhakti, what's unfavorable. When we hear more, when we understand that, and then this problem sort of goes away on its own. But when we're not in connection to knowing what pleases the Supreme Lord, what pleases his devotees, what's favorable, what's unfavorable, then we just use our own mind to think about what that is. And then again, you can't trust the mind. And so the cycle goes on. Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you. Thank you.